This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. General David Petraeus speaks.
I do think you have to talk to enemies. I mean, again, you got to set things up. You got to know who you're talking to. You got to have your objectives straight. All the rest of this stuff.
This stuff. As the U.S. Marines in Afghanistan launch what's being called one of the largest ground offensives since Vietnam, the voice of General David Petraeus is loud and clear to the enemy. Hearts and minds can wait. A 4th of July weekend surge. Fireworks for the Taliban. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Thursday, July 2nd, an unfolding ground offensive is where we begin in Afghanistan. On the line from Virginia is friend of The Takeaway and military expert for us, Sam Gardner, retired Air Force colonel. Sam Gardner, is this the Petraeus surge that we are seeing? We got the reports late last night of an offensive, a ground offensive taking place now against the Taliban in Afghanistan.
It certainly is a major ground offensive. 4,000 Marines, according to them, the biggest operation since Vietnam. But I don't think it's the Petraeus offensive. It wasn't meant to be like this. This was supposed to be hearts and minds. This was supposed to be about economic development. This was not supposed to be about large combat operations. But what we're seeing is a large combat operation.
Which poses a question, who's running the show here? David Petraeus of CENTCOM or General McChrystal, the newly installed commander in Afghanistan? That question for you, Sam Gardner, when we come back. More on Afghanistan in a moment, as well as a look at technology that either makes phones obsolete or turns you into a phone. That's also on the program. And the deal about Dillinger, America's love affair with bank robbers during a recession. And another look at the sensitive side of South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford. Is there any other side? We have all the news you need for this morning in the headlines. We start in California. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has declared a fiscal emergency and ordered state offices to close 3 days a month. That means unpaid leave for employees. 30 U.S. states missed the June 30th deadline to balance their budgets. In about 30 minutes, we'll get the latest numbers on the jobless rate. It's expected to jump 9.6% for June, and the jobless rate is what we want you to think about in our takeaway question. More about that in a moment. We'll have more on the U.S. offensive in southern Afghanistan up next in the show, but the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency is now involved in the Michael Jackson death investigation. Allegations have emerged that he had used painkillers, sedatives, and antidepressants. The DEA is looking into that. South Korea's defense minister has confirmed that the North test-fired two more short-range missiles today. Meanwhile, U.S. and Chinese officials are meeting in Beijing to talk about implementing U.N. sanctions against North Korea. Markets were mostly flat yesterday. Futures trading suggests a negative opening when Wall Street opens in about an hour and a half. The Dow begins at 8504. The S&P starts trading at 923, and the NASDAQ opens at 1846. So, in less than a half hour, unemployment numbers are out today, and so far, if you noticed, men have borne the brunt of more than 80% of job losses since the recession began. We want to see and listen and learn what you're seeing in your own communities. Are there effects of this, so many men being out of work that you think have broader sociological significance? Is it going to change men's and women's roles in the economy? And here's a thought. Is it the end of macho culture in America? Tell us your stories, economics, sociological, or otherwise, at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. We begin this morning with the breaking news out of Afghanistan. We've talked about it a little bit, but we're exploring and trying to learn the details of a major offensive that was launched last night in the southern province of Helmand, sending 4,000 Marines and 650 Afghan soldiers against the Taliban. Here's U.S. Marine spokesman Captain William Pelletier outlining the goals.
When we come in, we're going to stay. We're going to help provide security for them so that they can build up their own institutions of governance, reconstruction, get themselves on the road to a better future.
a worthy objective, but is it practical? And to explore it, we still have with us Colonel Sam Gardner. And from Kabul now, Paul Tait, specialist editor for Reuters, joins the conversation. Paul, good morning. And how would you describe the objectives as commanders are outlining them there in Afghanistan?
Good morning. So far, it seems the objective looks like being to push out of the main base in Helmand, where the Marines and other forces have been, and out into smaller communities where they plan to set up bases and take the ground from the Taliban, who've dominated in the past in the south and the east in Afghanistan. Certainly, it's a new strategy in this part of the world, at least. They do look like they want to try and win back the Afghan people, which is what General McChrystal has said since he took over not so long ago.
Well, Paul Tait, it sounds as though the tactic here is to gain territory as a prelude to actually beginning the task of village by village, bringing the tribal leaders in Afghanistan on the ground over to the side of this coalition force. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, that's been the problem up until this point. There haven't been enough NATO-led troops in the area to take ground and then to hold it. They'd go out on operations and they'd win back ground and then have to return to their bases at night and watch as the Taliban came back in to fill the vacuum. The plan now is to take the ground and to hold it, and by holding it, help Afghan communities rebuild and then move on to construction projects.
Paul Tait, has there been any discussion of potential casualties out of Afghanistan? I mean, so far, the casualty count in Afghanistan has been much less significant than what we've seen in Iraq. But this feels a little bit like an invasion force as a prelude to the kinds of counterinsurgency that Petraeus was doing as recently as a year and a half ago. What's the talk on casualties?
The military commanders here have made it quite clear over the last couple of months that when they begin this new phase of their strategy, that they do expect to encounter more casualties simply because there are more troops going to more different places. So far today, there have only been a couple of minor casualties and no real engagements to speak of. But over the course of the next few weeks and months, you would normally expect that there will unfortunately be more casualties, just as we saw in Iraq when the surge there got underway.
And we will be paying attention to all of that. Paul Tait, thanks for joining us, the specialist editor for Reuters based in Kabul, talking about the announcement last night that 4,000 Marines, perhaps the largest offensive, at least some sources are describing it that way, largest offensive by the Marines since Vietnam. Now, back into the conversation, Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner, a friend of the Takeaway and someone who often talks to us about military strategy and what might be the motive and objective of missions on the ground. Sam Gardner, it seemed as though Paul Tait was describing this, or I guess maybe I was characterizing as sort of a summary of what he was saying, that this amounts to a kind of invasion surge in Afghanistan to grab territory to begin a counterinsurgency campaign maybe months from now. Is that what you're hearing?
Well, yes, and in fact, there's an interesting sort of internal tension in what you just said, John, which is it's an offensive, a large-scale military offensive to do counterinsurgency. That's inconsistent within itself. I think what we're seeing is a move to bring Afghanistan to the press, to show that something big is going on, and to gain support for the next 18 months for the operations there. You recall the administration said we've got 2 years, or we're going to begin to lose support of the American people, we're going to lose support of the Europeans. We are 6 months into that. I think this is as much a message to Europe and to the United States as it is to the people of Afghanistan. This is an American operation. Notice that none of the press releases, none of the pictures show Afghan military, no announcements out of Kabul from Karzai about this operation. This is an American operation, and I think part of the audience is the American people.
Interesting. Well, here's Captain William Pelletier, Marine spokesman, speaking in Helmand province, presumably, as you say, Sam Gardner, to the American people. Listen.
International Security Assistance Force forces and U.S. Marines in particular are here to support them for them to build their own way of life. So we're here for as long as it takes.
Sounds like nation building to me, Sam Gardner.
Well, it does. And there's a it's interesting. It does, but it doesn't. The administration has had a problem with its strategy, I think. It's sort of a fundamental problem, which is this idea, and it sort of started in Iraq, which is we are going to build the nation of Afghanistan from the bottom up. We're going to start with small villages, and we'll build from there up. The problem with that, and really a problem we still have in Iraq, that doesn't build a nation of Afghanistan. You can't build a nation from the bottom up. There have to be institutions that hold a nation together. So that there is this idea that within itself has some problems, which is that you somehow make a nation of Afghanistan by having villages in Helmand Province that are strong and the people are getting what they want. So that we're seeing that unfold. And the other thing we're seeing unfold is the question that you asked me at the beginning is, who's in charge? That's a real tension right now, I think, within the U.S. administration. General Jones, the national security advisor,
right,
just returned from Afghanistan. He said there are people who don't recall that we have just agreed to a new strategy. I think there's some tension there,
really,
between the White House and McChrystal.
So there's tension between the White House and McChrystal. Is it possible that David Petraeus told McChrystal, look, the clock is ticking, but you have to take some territory and get some solid objectives in Afghanistan before you do any sort of, covert ops?
You know, I don't hear Petraeus in this. Have you seen any announcements from the Central Command within the last 3, 4, 5 months? Petraeus doesn't seem to be a major hand in what's going on right now.
Well, that's interesting, Sam. That's interesting. You're absolutely right about that, and I'm wondering what's going on.
Well, I think that, and what you heard was frustration from General Jones, who said, we had a strategy review, we agreed to this, now I have people, I'm quoting from his press interview, there are people out there who aren't seeming to follow the strategy. I had to go to Afghanistan to make sure that new generals, understood we had a strategy and we had decided which way to go.
Huh.
He then went on to say no more troops, at least until 2010.
Well, we should note that General McChrystal has started what I believe is the fifth review of strategy in Afghanistan in, I believe, just a few months. So they're definitely relooking at this one more time. But, I'm stepping back and I'm looking at the map here, Sam Gardner. And you've got an offensive that we have reported on for many weeks now of the Pakistani military going after the Taliban on the Pakistan side of the border. Now you've got an anti-Taliban offensive by the U.S. Marines on the Afghan side of the border. I mean, somewhere in the middle there is al-Qaeda. Are we actually looking at the final offensive to get bin Laden, and Pakistan and the United States are on the same side?
Well, I think that the really admirable part of this operation is it is being coordinated between the U.S. and Pakistan. According to press reports this morning, the Pakistan military has moved troops to the border with the Helmand Province into what the military would call blocking positions, so that as the Marines move in, there's no place, or there aren't as many places for the Taliban to move back into Pakistan. So that's a very positive development, the fact that Pakistan and U.S. operations are now being coordinated.
Well, Sam Gardner, it'd be hard to imagine a more powerful message to the American people if General Jones is up to that than delivering bin Laden or al-Qaeda in a coordinated action with the U.S. and Pakistan. Thanks so much, Sam Gardner, retired Air Force colonel who has taught strategy at the National War College, on the line from Virginia, helping us to understand an offensive that was announced last night, possibly the biggest Marine offensive in Afghanistan since Vietnam, although other assessments are saying it's the biggest offensive since Fallujah in Iraq.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. So unemployment numbers are out on a Thursday rather than the normal Friday this week because of the 4th of July holiday to give us something lovely to think about for the holiday. But if you've looked at the recession, and we like to get behind the numbers in economics, 80% of the job losses since the recession began are men. What do you think and what are you seeing? Are you seeing any effects where you live of so many men being out of work?
So men are leading, are bearing the brunt of unemployment. How about men whine more than women? How about at every opportunity where men can draw attention to their quote-unquote suffering, they do?
Perhaps more evidence that macho culture is ending in America. How do you think the unemployment rate and the effect of men on the unemployment rate is going to affect male-female relationships in the United States? There's one view. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. So you've heard this before, right? Technology is liberating.
Give me a 3-4-4-J. Thank you kindly.
Don't talk too long, Graham. Supper will be ready in a few minutes.
Hello. Ed? Well, get along close to your phone. Ain't gonna bite you, Ed.
Dial telephone? Yes, I did hear something about it down at the grocery store this morning.
Yes, technology liberates us. That's what we hear all the time. But then why did telephones enslave us? They enslaved us to wires for generations, and they still enslave us to numbers that must be memorized and dialed. Well, now that Google is officially rolling out a free phone management service, phone use potentially may become more like email and instant messaging. We're just identities, and the information that's trying to reach us finds us and follows us wherever we are, and we can choose to pay attention to it or not. What does this mean? New York Times technology editor Sam Grobart is here. And Sam, this is about getting rid of the 10-digit phone number on one level, but it seems bigger than that, wouldn't you say?
I think it is. I think it's basically, well, it's a couple of things. It's pretty much the end of voicemail, as far as I'm concerned. And
that's a good thing.
Yeah, it is a good thing. It's a lot more convenient. And it's also treating voice like data, which is essentially what it is, and allowing you to manipulate it and manage it as you see fit.
So what does this mean in practical terms, and what is the capability that Google Voice, which I guess is still in beta,
right,
which is entertaining all by itself, and will be rolled out officially in a couple of weeks, what is it able to do that hasn't been possible up till now?
Well, Google Voice has been around before. It was called Grand Central. And what it does is it gives you a new phone number, and you give that number out to your friends and your coworkers and whomever. They dial that number, and it will ring every phone you've attached to that number. So now you just have one phone number you have for your mobile, for your home phone, for at work. And it has call management features, which allow people to leave you a message, but then allows you to look at that message online, transcribed. It allows you to hear it online. It allows you to send certain calls to voicemail. It's like you have your own personal assistant, basically.
So it gets rid of this issue of I don't have a pencil to take down that number, because you can actually take whatever piece of information that's in your voice and channel it into text so it can come up on your phone. And that can include anything from directions to my house to an actual map, right?
That's right. It'll basically take anything you say. It'll do a pretty good job. It's kind of interesting to see how well it does that transcription service. And it will allow you to see that on your computer, your smartphone, wherever you happen to be.
All right. Well, here, Dylan, we've got this tape here that actually begins to explain this. I'm talking to Dylan in the control room there. So we've got you reading something into this Google Voice, and then we're going to see how well it transcribes. First, here's you reading.
Hey, Jim, it's Sam. I'm going to read you the first paragraph of the Gettysburg Address, okay? Here goes. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Hope that's good. Thanks. Bye.
All right. Now, Google Voice converts that to text and can send it to any platform that you have to deliver that message, so you don't have to dial up your voicemail to hear your messages.
Exactly.
And you can get the message easily, and you know, it takes you a second to look at the text. But here's what Google Voice transcribed your message. It's a little garbled. I just want to warn you.
Okay.
Hey, Jim, it's Amber. I'm going to read you the first tire track of the Gettysburg Address. Okay, it goes 47 years ago. That's getting better. Our fathers brought four upon this company. I'm going to actually conceived in liberty and dedicated for the proposition that all men are created equal. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Amber?
Amber. Yeah, what's that about?
I kind of like it.
Well, it's right. Because you're a geek and you love the technology.
Right.
I don't want Google garbling my messages and changing my identity.
No. It's expected that voice recognition software will obviously improve. And one of the things that Google Voice is already very good at is taking down phone numbers, for example. So while it may garble some text,
it definitely gets the numbers.
It gets the numbers fine.
And ultimately, are we looking at an era where all we are is the identity of our name? And
right.
The platforms are something that computers sort out, and maybe, I guess, satellites and brain implants figure out where we actually are, and that's something for the NSA, but that's where
right.
we're headed.
That's pretty much the deal. I mean, the idea is that you'll have text, voice, images, video, all being sent around and picked up by you wherever you happen to be, something in your hand, something on your desk, something at a terminal somewhere else. It'll all just be out there in the ether, basically.
And, of course, Google wants to be there first, and we want to check in with this technology as it makes its way into the mainstream. Sam Grobart, personal technology editor for The New York Times, thanks so much for being with us. And we want to remind you, you can actually experiment with this technology. And we use it actually here on the show every day in our spin box, where you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. But go to our website, and there are directions for you to play a game of telephone where we can, in an entertaining way, take a look at some of the imperfections of this technology. The directions are all there. Just go to takeaway.org, play telephone, read the Gettysburg Address for this 4th of July. It's kind of a patriotic thing to do. And we'll report on some of the transcription outcomes, I guess it's fair to say, tomorrow. Mark Garrison has our headlines.
Thank you. 28 minutes after the hour, a major U.S. offensive against the Taliban is now underway in southern Afghanistan. About 4,000 Marines and hundreds of Afghan troops are attacking insurgents. They want to clear the area of insurgents before the late August presidential election. Also, insurgents in eastern Afghanistan have captured an American soldier. The search is on. That soldier was not part of the new offensive going on in the other part of the country. Several states' budgets are in trouble, including California's. The governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, is declaring a fiscal emergency. He's ordering more state offices closed to save money. California is ready to issue billions of dollars in IOUs. The Drug Enforcement Administration is joining the investigation of Michael Jackson's death. They'll help local police look into the extent of prescription drug use and any doctors involved. This afternoon, President Obama meets with business leaders to discuss new ways to save money and create jobs. Later on, he'll head to Camp David ahead of the July 4th holiday. And also the young French girl that we've been talking about this week, who was the only survivor of the Yemeni plane crash in the Indian Ocean. She's now back with her father in Paris. John.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Well, it's one of these this-just-in moments. The unemployment rate, 9.5%, which was lower than what analysts were expecting in the June unemployment number, which just came out. But payrolls dropped dropped a larger-than-expected 460,000. So jobless rate 9.5%, it's a 26-year high, and it's mostly affecting men in this economy. And we're talking about whether that has implications for the idea of macho in America. Have you noticed this movie, Public Enemies? It comes out this week. During the Depression, Americans were fascinated by John Dillinger, who's a central character in that movie. Johnny Depp, who's macho all by himself, is playing an even more macho John Dillinger, who was gunned down by G-men in Chicago back in the 1930s. On the line with us, Jeff Scaife, great nephew of big John Dillinger, joins us from Mooresville, Indiana. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, John. How are you?
Now, let's not endorse crime here together on this advance of the holiday weekend, but what is it about America's love affair with bank robbers?
Well, I've always believed that America likes their heroes with a rough edge around them. For whatever reason, it seems to be something in our social makeup. Our founding fathers were really, not to insult them by any means, but they really were terrorists in the minds of the British. And we've always had that rough edge. And Americans seem to like people that will stand up and face what they believe to be injustice and answer it in somewhat of a vigilante way. Yeah. And I think that's something that seems to be uniquely American.
Well, Jeff Scaife, here's J. Edgar Hoover, played by Billy Crudup from the film Public Enemies, in the voice of the American government standing up to John Dillinger. Listen.
Agent Melvin Purvis will be in charge of the field office in Chicago, the center of the crime wave sweeping America. His task will be to get public enemy number one, John Dillinger.
So Jeff, as great nephew of John Dillinger, to hear him say public enemy number one, does that give you a twinge of pride in any sense, even in this sort of rough-edged, complex, ambiguous way?
Well, not me personally. Yeah, I always, my grandmother, who was John's sister, always said, do not romanticize him, do not villainize him. He wasn't mean-spirited. He wasn't vicious. He was not a killer. He never intended to hurt anyone. To her, he was a big brother, and she always said that her father, who was a deacon in a Christian church, always tried to get John to give up and to leave the country. But no, it doesn't give me a sense of pride.
Would have been some good advice if he'd actually taken it. Joining us now is Elliot Gorn, who's a professor of history at Brown University. His book is called Dillinger's Wild Ride, The Year That Made America's Public Enemy Number One. Professor Gorn, good morning to you, first of all.
Good morning.
And have you seen this movie?
Yes, I did.
What do you think of it?
Well, I liked it. I'm not sure what I think of it as history. Films are a tough way to get history. It's a good film. It's a very exciting film. It's nothing but action. Whether it really gets at John Dillinger, I'm not so sure.
Well, what are the pieces of the legend of John Dillinger as people understood it, maybe back in the period of the Depression? And quite literally, the fact that he was robbing banks meant he was robbing the very people that were foreclosing on homes all over the United States in the 1930s.
Well, I think that's exactly right, and I think that's one of the reasons for many, many people he was a heroic figure. I think a lot of people were genuinely ambivalent. This is the depth of the Great Depression, 1933, 1934, the deepest moments in the Great Depression. When Dillinger first starts gaining public attention, literally thousands of banks had just closed their doors, had destroyed family savings, retirement businesses, and so on. People didn't like social disorder. They didn't like crime. They were not happy that innocent people were sometimes being taken hostage and dying. And yet, at the same time, there's a sense, at least here's a man who's doing something, taking matters into his own hand. There is, as Jeffrey said, there's a kind of rough edge about him, but a kind of heroism in his being a renegade, a rebel.
And, he was a mysterious figure to most Americans, and you get that sense in this scene from the movie.
I don't know anything about you.
I was raised on a farm in Mooresville, Indiana. My mama died when I was 3. My daddy beat the hell out of me because he didn't know no better way to raise me. like baseball, movies, good clothes, fast cars, whiskey, and you. What else you need to know?
Jeff Skaft, does that ring true? You're there in Mooresville, and I imagine you might have seen that farm.
Well, I actually live in the Dillinger farmhouse. That particular quote, I can tell you, is one that my grandmother would take exception to. John Sr. Was a very successful immigrant. He unlike so many of the period, for lack of a better phrase, crime families, was somewhat successful. He was upper middle class. He was a grocer. He owned three homes. He had done quite well for himself and then had decided that since they were from the French Rhineland, he wanted to return to his first love, which was farming, and he married Elizabeth Fields. It's and the name is actually pronounced Dillinger.
I see. So she would take objection to the fact that he was raised in a tough, abusive environment.
Yes.
Yeah,
John Sr. was the type of man that really felt that an individual was responsible for their own actions.
Right.
He encouraged John during the time that John committed his first crime to stand up and take his punishment.
Well, he eventually did pay dearly for all of those crimes. Jeff Skaft, we want to continue this conversation on our website, where the discussion really is going to be about whether John Dillinger embodies a notion of macho in the United States that is dying. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us. Elliot Gorin, you want to take that question before we leave? Is John Dillinger an element of macho?
Oh, God. You know, let me just turn the question around just
quickly.
A little bit. The film is about gangsters. John Dillinger was about outlaws. He's about the countryside, the heartland. I think that's a big distinction. It's much more Indiana in some ways, the story as people understand it, than it is Chicago.
Elliot Gorin, professor of history at Brown University, and Jeff Skaft, great nephew of John Dillinger. We're talking about the film Public Enemies, about John Dillinger, macho figure in American history. It opens up this weekend, and Mark Garrison has the headlines.
Thank you, John. 20 minutes before the hour, and the new monthly unemployment rate is just out as of a few moments ago. It's now at 9.5%. That's more than a quarter century high, but it's just a bit lower than what economists expected. We're covering this all morning with fresh analysis, and we'll meet some of the people behind those numbers. A major U.S. offensive against the Taliban is underway in southern Afghanistan right now. 4,000 Marines and hundreds of Afghan troops are striking the Taliban stronghold, and June was the deadliest month for Iraqis this year. More than 440 civilians were killed. That's nearly double the number from May. John.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. As we do continually on this program, we try to get some sort of faces and voices behind the dizzying number of economic statistics that we report on all the time. Car sales were reported yesterday, and they're really all over the map. Volvo's doing pretty well. Ford is doing okay. And GM and Chrysler are having continual troubles. And, of course, as we know, they're in bankruptcy. Joining now is Mark Porter, president and dealer of Mark Porter GM Supercenter in Pomeroy, Ohio. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, John. How are you?
I'm doing great. And Dale Hart, retired from the Navy and also an employee at the Syracuse Racing Regional Sewer District, on the line from Racine, Ohio. Dale Hart, how are you?
Fine. Yourself?
Now, Mark Porter, you're a seller, correct?
Yes.
Dale Hart, you're a buyer of cars, as I understand
yes.
it.
Yes.
Explain to me why you're buying.
Well, it was time for me to buy, and I believe that GM is going to be around when I'm long gone, so I stick with a product that I like.
How old are you, Dale?
I'm 68.
And GM's going to be around as long as you're alive?
Oh, yes, and then some.
And then some. Is that really positive news for GM? You're going to live to 100, right?
I hope so.
All right, good. Mark Porter, what was the pitch that you gave to Dale Hart to sell him, I understand, two cars?
really didn't have to give Dale a good pitch. He's a good General Motors customer. We live down in the tri-state area of southern Ohio, and it's good General Motors or domestic car country. He bought a truck and an Impala and with his wife, and they wanted to support the country by buying, you know, a GM car, and we live in the part of the country that buys a lot of domestic automobiles.
So, Mark, how many people are contacting you just to find out about whether you're in business or not, and how many of those people actually become customers?
Quite a few, actually. Most customers in our area know who we are, so their biggest concern was initially, before the bankruptcy, was whether, A, we were going to be in business as a dealer, and two, was whether GM was going to be in business. Now that the bankruptcy has taken place and they see that Chevrolet and General Motors is going to survive, business is picking up. We've seen a spark last month in increased sales, and the uncertainty is now leaving the market. So they know that having seen Chrysler come through it, and they're out and they're selling cars and building them again. And GM's almost out of it, and they're building cars and coming out of it. So people have confidence again that basically the uncertainty's gone.
Very quickly, is this an opportunity that might not be repeated to buy a car and hold down a value that's really not going to be revisited in the next decade?
I totally believe that. I think the consumer a year from now is going to wish everybody bought a car this year.
Interesting. Dale Hart, are those two cars out in your driveway right now?
They're both in the garage.
In the garage? That must make you feel good.
Oh, yes, it does.
Makes me feel good.
All right. Well, Mark Porter and Dale Hart, thanks so much for joining the Takeaway this morning. Mark Porter is president and dealer of Mark Porter GM Supercenter in Pomeroy, Ohio. And Dale Hart is a customer two times, 67 years old, and GM's going to be around longer than he is.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Based on the latest figures, unemployment stands at 9.5%. Mark Garrison's going to have more about that in just a moment. But we want to hear what you're hearing and seeing in your own community. For instance, you know this statistic, 80% of the unemployment in this recession is men out of work.
It is a travesty that men are out of work in the numbers that they are, especially minorities, because they are the ones that's hit most. But I'm also ashamed that there are not more men in the home. So it's a catch-22 situation. We need to fix this because our society is crumbling from my point of view. My name is Tanya Barber. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia.
Thank you, Tanya. Tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Mark Garrison has the headlines now.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, a major U.S. offensive against the Taliban is going on in southern Afghanistan right now, with nearly 4,000 Marines and hundreds of Afghan troops battling insurgents. They want to drive them out before the Afghan presidential election next month. In California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has declared a fiscal emergency and ordered new state office closures. That means unpaid leave for employees there. Dozens of other states missed this week's deadline to balance their budget. Federal officials say at least 12 are hospitalized for a possible E. coli outbreak in beef that's made people sick in 9 states. Tom Skinner is with the Centers for Disease Control.
As the outbreak investigation continues, we wouldn't be surprised to see more cases and possibly more states as state health departments start looking more carefully at cases of E. coli infections in their state.
The beef that they're focusing on is from the JBS Swift Beef Company. It's sold in a lot of different stores under different names. It can be confusing, but we're going to help you out. Our web goddess Melissa has more information on the recall at thetakeaway.org. She doesn't eat meat, but we promise she's reporting the story without bias. Looking abroad for a minute, South Korea's defense minister has confirmed that the North test-fired 2 more short-range missiles. And meanwhile, the U.S. and Chinese officials are meeting in Beijing to talk about implementing U.N. sanctions against North Korea. John.
Web goddess?
Yeah, she
Thank you,
she
Mark.
She does a good job.
Mark Garrison. And now another look at the sensitive side of South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford.
I developed a relationship with what started as a dear, dear friend from Argentina.
This was a whole lot more than a simple affair, but it's a love story. A forbidden one, a tragic one, but a love story at the end of the day. If you come into connection with a soul that touches yours in a way that no one's ever has, even if it's a place you can't go, this notion of knowing that you know, for me, became very, very important.
Well, we couldn't resist. But Cindy Mosteller, former chairman of the Charleston County Republican Party, part of an evangelical organization that is rallying behind Mark Sanford's wife, Jenny. Good morning to you, first of all. And what are your feelings about your governor at this moment?
You know, I hope my feelings are more concentrated in my thoughts and that I'm not running away with those. And our feelings are shock. We cannot believe it. We don't accept it. We find no justification for it, and quite honestly, we find it somewhat bizarre and unstabling, disturbing. Those are just some of the adjectives that I would describe this.
Well, let's review the bidding for all of those Americans who've been living under a rock since last Thursday. Mark Sanford, of course, came clean with the affair he's been having with a woman down in Argentina. He was actually AWOL for several days down in Argentina with her. And women in South Carolina, after these revelations came out, have wanted to make it clear that they stand with the governor's wife. And there's an online campaign called Stand With Jenny. And Cindy Mosteller, you're affiliated with that, along with Becky Robbins, who's a communications director for the South Carolina Progressive Network. Good morning to you, Becky.
Good morning.
Becky, how are you feeling about the sort of sensitive male idea that Mark Sanford seems to be portraying in some of these interviews?
Well, I guess as a radio host, you probably don't want to hear this, but words really fail me. I kind of wish they would also fail our governor, who just can't seem to stop talking. It's been a very, very long week in South Carolina.
But, you know, he is playing on some assumption that women like guys who, you know, want to talk about their feelings and stuff. And it seems to me what you're saying is absolutely not. Just go away.
Well, in the beginning, I was kind of sympathetic. I think that matters of the heart are a messy business. And the press conference was stunning and a little bit heartbreaking because it's clear that the man is in love, and I don't think, I mean, it was really hard to process that, and I was very sympathetic at first and not quick to rush to judgment. But since then, it's been just bizarre.
Yeah.
The revelations that came out in the AP story recently when he went on and on about, that this was his soulmate and that this wasn't an affair but a love story. And that he was going to try to fall back in love with his wife. I mean, that went from just being kind of clueless to cruel, I thought.
Right, right. Well, Cindy Mosteller, what is Jenny doing as far as the women in South Carolina understand it? And what are they saying about what her response ought to be?
Well, we've seen amazing strength. I think this is not a person who has gotten over love for her husband, that emotional attachment. In the midst of this great pain, Jenny has stood strong. We so appreciate that she just did not stand by her man through this sordid story. How can she stand by that and also stand with the dignity that is Jenny Sanford? And so in response to that, there are many people, sometimes often the first step is people are resistant to taking a stand against somebody. And so this petition for Jenny at palmettocouncil.org has given the women, the citizens of South Carolina, to take a stand for someone who's standing by her family, not necessarily by her husband's story, with great dignity, with great resolve, and even with an openness to forgiveness. Although it seems that Sanford, to me, is going to be very difficult for him to go back down the road once he's written the love story in front of us all that he claims to be so involved in.
Cindy,
we find it's somewhat bizarre and narcissistic, unstable.
Well, Cindy, first you, and then Becky, if you could respond to the same question. Tell me about some conversations you've had with friends as this unfolded from a kind of a wives and mothers perspective there in South Carolina.
I tell you, it's what's interesting to me as a person involved in politics is that the conversations have not only been among friends and family. My dog was recently lost in a neighborhood about two neighborhoods over, talking to the people, did not even know they would know who I was. I've been on television on this issue, and all of a sudden a man from Pittsburgh, not a Southerner, not necessarily a Bible belter, looks at me and says, this man must go. This is not the man I voted for. And you see it in grocery lines, at the movie theater, and the consensus is the polls down here, the online polls, are about 85% that he should resign.
Wow.
This smacks at what everyone knows is essential to keeping not only families together, but governments together. It's now to the point that I think there's strong consensus that he is unable to govern not only within himself, but who in this state would be willing to be governed by a man acting such as this?
Well, except weren't we all governed by Bill Clinton?
Well, I'm not sure I was. We weren't a part of that process getting him up there.
All right. Well, Becky, I want your quick response. Well, response, whatever. Don't make it quick. Whatever. What conversations have you been having?
Well, they've been all over the map. I think that people are just really having a hard time processing this. From my friends, feel like that he hasn't really been governing the state for the last 6.5 years. It's been among the most ineffective administrations in memory. So we don't really feel like there's much to lose, whether he resigns or whether he stays in office. I think South Carolina is just really waiting for the next administration.
And a political future in Argentina, who knows?
Well,
Cindy Mosteller and Becky Robbins, we want to help you process this, all right?
Okay.
All right, so just listen to this as we say goodbye to you.
Thanks.
Oh, yes. It's so good. Our thanks to Cindy Mosteller, former chairman of the Charleston County Republican Party, part of an organization that is Standing with Jenny, wife of Mark Sanford. Also, Becky Robbins, communications director for South Carolina Progressive Network. Earlier, we had a segment on a new phone management service Google is offering. Joanne wrote to us about it. She reminds us that similar services are provided by other companies. This is not new, she writes. Vonage has been offering most of the services for years. When someone calls my home phone, my cell phone rings too, and they offer voice-to-text sent via email. Good point, Joanne. We featured Google because it's the first company to offer the services free of charge. Here's your takeaway, by the way.
The plan now is to take the ground and to hold it, and by holding it, help Afghan communities rebuild and then move on to construction projects.
It's Paul Tate, specialist editor for Reuters. We talked to him this morning about the major U.S. offensive in the southern part of Afghanistan that is taking place today. So we want to hear your feelings about Mark Sanford and the whole issue of being macho in America. The unemployment rate is out, and mostly men have been affected in this recession. It's changing America, changing the way men and women relate to each other. We're going to talk about that, and on the website, you can go and be a part of it, or just call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with what you're seeing in your community. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I think we can all agree that Tony Montana is muy, muy macho.
I call my lawyer. He's the best lawyer in Miami. He's such a good lawyer that by tomorrow morning, you're going to be working in Alaska. So dress warm.
Yikes. In the age of sensitive Governor Mark Sanford and Bill Clinton, maybe Scarface just doesn't cut it anymore. And this recession is hitting male workers harder than any other category. Breadwinners without bread are losers? The Death of Macho, the sociology of today's unemployment figures, sex and economics. You know it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. You want to talk to my little friend, huh? John Huckleberry here. It's Thursday, July 2nd. A provocative look at the unemployment figures in just a moment and masculinity in America. Also, a healthcare emergency in South Florida produces some local reform and surging Marines in Afghanistan. More about that, but first, the headlines. And in the headlines, major U.S. offensive against the Taliban going on in southern Afghanistan right now. Nearly 4,000 Marines, hundreds of Afghan troops battling insurgents. And news this morning on the jobless rate, it jumped to 9.5% in June. That's lower than analysts expected, but still a 26-year high. And most of the people being affected by the recession are men. Raihan Salam is a fellow at the New America Foundation and editor of The American Scene. He joins us now from Washington. Raihan, good morning.
Good morning to you.
If men are being affected by the recession, does this have an effect on macho culture in the United States?
I think it does. I think it reveals that macho is more bravado than it is built on any kind of reality. So I think that that's something that's going to ripple through the culture for a long time.
So Audacia Ray, author of Naked on the Internet and adjunct professor of sexuality at Rutgers University, is that good news?
Well, I mean, I think more than anything, this is an admission of guilt from corporate culture that women do indeed make less than men, so they're a better financial bet.
All right. Well, the death of macho is like premature, or was it gone a long time ago?
I mean,
I think it was gone a long time ago. Sorry, Adisha.
No. I mean, I think for sure it's been transitioning out, and there is definitely a new masculinity happening in the United States today.
Transitioning masculinity. We want to talk about that all hour long. But first, in other headlines, in California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has declared a fiscal emergency, and the state is ready to issue billions in IOUs starting today. What are those going to look like? The Federal Drug Enforcement Agency is getting involved in the investigation of Michael Jackson's death after allegations have emerged that he used painkillers, sedatives, and antidepressants. And South Korea's defense minister has confirmed that the North has test-fired two more short-range missiles. Meanwhile, U.S. and Chinese officials are meeting in Beijing to talk about implementing U.N. sanctions against North Korea. Markets were mostly flat yesterday, and the futures suggest a really negative opening on Wall Street when the markets open in about a half hour. The Dow opens at 85.04, the Nasdaq 18.46, the S&P starts trading at 9.23. So, as we said, new unemployment numbers are out. So far in this recession, men have largely borne the brunt of job losses. And what does that mean? What are the visible effects of this in your community? We're going to talk about the sociology of the recession in just a moment. Are men turning to different industries since traditionally male occupations are down? What are you seeing? 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us, mytake@thetakeaway.org. Answer this question. Is macho dead in America?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckleberry here. Call it the soft underbelly of the U.S. economy. The new unemployment numbers just out about 30 minutes ago. A larger than expected 467,000 jobs were cut in June, driving the unemployment rate up to a 26-year high of 9.5%. Lower than the consensus 9.6% estimate, but it suggests that the economy's road to recovery is going to be bumpy. Since the recession began in December 2007, the economy has lost a net total of 6.5 million jobs, which is hitting men particularly hard. More about that in a moment. But Michael Doyle, Vice President and General Manager of the Southeast Division of Manpower Incorporated in Washington, D.C. You're actually in the Department of Labor cafeteria right now.
I am, John. How are you this morning?
So a lot of long faces. People are just sort of depressed, sitting there, just pushing their lattes away and going, all hope is lost.
I don't believe that, John. I think people drinking lattes trying to figure out how to get people back to work.
And what are you doing today?
We're actually doing a workshop with the Department of Labor. Clearly, this impacts the temporary industry as a whole. So we're trying to partner with them and learn what strategies that they're executing on a local, regional, national level that we can support to help train, assess, or get people back into emerging markets. Because there's clearly a lot of jobs that are still hard to fill today.
All right. Well, Michael Doyle, sit tight there. We're going to unpack some of these statistics with Kelly Evans, economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal, our friend here in the studio in New York, Kelly Evans. First of all, what what's the big headline out of this latest unemployment number, in your view?
The headline is definitely the number of jobs that were lost last month. You know, we sort of had seen improvement from January each month with the economy shedding fewer and fewer jobs. Again, hard to say it's a good thing, but it was at least an encouraging move. And then, you know, in June to go and post a big decline again. But, you know, there are two pieces of data. That's one. The other is the unemployment rate. And that is highly visible for a lot of people. They sort of just get it immediately. So it's a very important number. That was only up by, you know, a tenth of a point to 9.5%. You know, it's a high number, but that's the smallest gain we've seen really since the economy and the financial crisis, you know, got a lot worse last fall.
Let's remind people that the actual unemployment rate, the effective unemployment rate, is 9.5 plus the discouraged workers and the part-timers, which adds up to what sort of a rate?
As of June, the U6 rate, which includes those other workers, was 16.5%.
16.5%.
Yeah, and there was also a big increase in the unemployment rate among teenagers in particular.
Let's shift back to the payrolls for just a second. There's a lot of numbers that come out this week around the time of the unemployment stats. And there are these so-called ADP numbers that look at big and medium-sized businesses, how many jobs they lost. What does that say?
Well, the ADP figures yesterday are kind of meant to give people a sense of what today's numbers might look like. And I have to say, they sort of warned that we could see a little bit of weakness today. You know, we didn't see quite the improvement. They found that private sector payrolls, you know, fell by, you know, nearly 400,000 again last month. So there are different ways of gauging how bad the axe is falling. But again, I think a lot of people right now are at this point of saying the free fall's ended. You know, where are we now in the economy? The second half of the year began yesterday or with July 1st. So the second half recovery, you know, are these numbers supporting it? Or, you know, is the economy going to get itself together? And are we going to have this sort of lagging problem in the labor market where after 2001, by the way, when the recession ended in November, the unemployment rate didn't peak until mid-2003.
Mm. So it's fair to say that looking at all these numbers on Planet Wonk, where you live, that they're all kind of exhibiting the same trend, that discouraging news going forward, but no real big negative surprises. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say. And I think that at 9.5%, if we continue to see sort of flatness here in the labor market, it is possible that we could stay under that double-digit unemployment rate. So again, just giving us a sense of how bad things are, I will say the loss of 6.5 million jobs since the recession began, as one group noted this morning, takes us back to the overall employment level the economy had in 2000. It wipes out 9 years.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
And most of those in the 6.5 million are men. Raihan Salam, fellow at the New America Foundation and editor of The American Scene, want to welcome you back. First of all, what is the sociological significance? This number really adds to a trend that you've already talked about.
I was perusing Kelly's newspaper and saw that a lot of that payroll decline happened in manufacturing and construction. And those, of course, are sectors that are not only really dominated by men, but that have a lot to do with, you know, our thoughts about blue-collar work and, you know, kind of the identity of men as economic providers. So I think that the impact is going to be pretty big.
And let's talk about in this population of men who are being laid off. I mean, you've got workers who are high seniority who maybe have only had one or two jobs in the economy. The impact of essentially a first-time layoff is pretty significant and is likely to ripple through families and outward into communities. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. So, you know, before the late 70s, early 80s, you actually didn't have a gap between African-American men and white men in terms of unemployment. And then suddenly you saw a huge gap open up there. And what was the driver of that gap? The driver was you saw these guys who didn't have a high school diploma necessarily, but who were able to get decent jobs in the past. Then that changed, and that disproportionately affected African-American men. And you still have this big, big effect where there's just a huge, huge gap with the economic prospects of African-Americans in general having been impacted by that very badly. So are we seeing another kind of inflection point where the economic prospects between men and women are now sharply differentiating? I don't think that's necessarily true, but it could be, partly because that housing boom that we had, which was mostly illusory for the last decade, was something that really propped up men's economic prospects. So when you see something like construction evaporate at a really, really fast clip, that's just really bad for men, and you wonder, what's going to replace that as as the kind of basis for, you know, men's economic well-being.
Well, we've already had one woman call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and suggest that men love to whine about their own misfortunes in an economy where women have had to deal with this for a long time. Michael Doyle, when individuals enter the unemployed who are coming from a position of being very secure and feeling that things would never change for them, how much more difficult is it to get them back into an employment situation and maybe a different kind of job than it is for people who've been bouncing around for maybe a long time?
Well, I think it's a little bit harder in the short term, maybe a little bit easier in the long term. Clearly, someone that's had a diverse background, varying jobs, or you know, a career path that's not its niche is maybe engineering or finance or IT, a company's going to may be able to use them in multiple spots. You know, an engineer, male or female, if they're an electrical engineer, they're an electrical engineer. So if they try to be something else, then clearly they're going to have to retool their skills via education, community college, or an extended degree to find a new opportunity, and that just takes longer.
Now, working for Manpower Incorporated, you work in an industry that basically is looking for the pool of easily placeable temps, right?
Not necessarily. We do both the executive search, permanent placement work. We do a lot of consulting, and then your true traditional, what Manpower's been doing for 60 years, the real short-term temporary assignment. But we do a lot of executive work as well.
Now, let me just, I don't want to get you fired here, all right? But I do want to ask a question.
Let's not do that today,
and I won't get myself fired either. But in this economy right now, without suggesting that you're discriminating against anybody on the basis of race or gender or anything, is there an ideal category that is most easily placeable in this economy right now, either by age, gender, or any other category?
I think skill sets still rule the world. So I wouldn't say that any demographic, if you're a plumber or a machinist or a welder, you know, the skilled trades, you can get work. There's still a need, you know, race aside, for some very, very strong skilled individuals. Many of the IT services, I know the professional services market took about 120,000 hit this month. But even in that space, they're very niche jobs for people with expertise that are still hard to fill. We just posted our top 10 list, and it's, you know, healthcare, engineers, technicians, welders, skilled trades. If you have those skills, you can go to work pretty much no matter what.
All right. Well, Michael Doyle, it looks like you're still employed, I'd say, at this point. Kelly Evans, do you see that list in your statistics when you look, the skilled trades do the best?
It definitely does help, I think, right now, not only to have that skill, but also to have the education and the resume. I think the difficult thing is that you do have this surge of workers who came from one industry or trying to get into another, say, healthcare, and finding that amidst insane competition, they just can't get an edge on the people who have the perfect background for it. So hopefully you are that person, and if not, it's really difficult for you to find a job right now.
All right, so finally, in under a minute, Raihan Salam, is macho dead, and is the new macho a flexibility that maybe women workers exhibit more than men?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's interesting. Your caller was talking about how men whine. Men do more than whine. They lie on the sofa and they drink. And they just drink themselves into a stupor.
They drink wine sometimes.
Kind of make this kind of tension and pain vanish. And when that happens to an entire country or an entire economy, it's a disaster.
Raihan Salam, fellow at the New America Foundation, editor of The American Scene. Thanks for helping us with these unemployment statistics. Thanks, as always, to Kelly Evans, economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And Michael Doyle, good luck getting people jobs today.
I appreciate it, John. You guys have a great day.
Michael Doyle works for Manpower Incorporated Southeast Division in Washington, D.C. Thanks to all of you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Just about an hour ago, the unemployment rate was announced. The government says it's 9.5%. So far, men have borne most of those job losses during this recession, which could be sociologically significant. What are you seeing?
I really do think that we're seeing the change in men's roles based on the 80% of the unemployed that are men now. The difficulty with that, of course, is that men as a gender have not found a way to adapt to that psychologically. So it is a challenge for the family. It is a challenge for men.
Well, how has that shown up in your community? Do you see men doing more work in the home, taking care of kids, shopping for groceries? Does this indicate a major change in the traditional role for men in the U.S. economy? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Health industry groups are expected to deliver.
If you like the plan you have, you can keep it.
To take over the healthcare system, either directly or indirectly, for the government to control it.
A lot of my friends, where they get their healthcare from is the emergency room. They're in the emergency room every week. They break a nail in the emergency room.
How are you going to avoid not having the ability to cost shift as you shrink that portion of privately funded health insurance?
Another look at health care reform, which is what Washington is dealing with these days. But joining us now is Josh Johnson, reporter and anchor for WLRN, Miami Herald News, who attended the first day of signups last night of a program in South Florida that is actually taking health care reform into their own local hands, not waiting for Washington at all. What are the people in Miami-Dade County doing, Josh?
John, good morning. They've created a program in Miami-Dade County called Miami-Dade Blue, which they basically bidded out for local insurance companies who wanted to create a county health plan to cover the 600,000 people in Miami-Dade County who have no coverage. Essentially what it is...
But let me just stop you there. So basically Miami-Dade County just said, we've got thousands of uninsured, we're going to get them insured, boom. So they take action.
And here's the crazy thing about it. Of the 600,000 people in Miami-Dade who have no coverage, 80% of them have jobs. So it's not like these people are just totally indigent. They're either people who work two part-time jobs and neither one provides insurance. They're people who work seasonal jobs and they can't get insurance year-round. Maybe they're freelancers, they work in the construction industry, or they work for small businesses that don't provide coverage. So these are people who otherwise would be able to pay for health insurance, they just can't get it.
So was this a hot ticket last night in Miami, the first day of signups?
Yeah, they met in a high school cafeteria in northwest Miami-Dade and had a packed house of people speaking English, Spanish, and Creole, asking tons of questions. And by the end of the event, there was a long line snaking around the cafeteria of people with the little application sheets in their hands ready to sign up.
Now, one of the people involved is the president of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Florida, Penny Schaefer. And why, first of all, what's in it for her? And then I want to hear from her in just a second.
Well, Blue Cross Blue Shield is a nonprofit health company, and so they believe that there's obviously a public mandate that they need to cover these folks before their health care needs become urgent, before they become that person who breaks a nail and ends up in the emergency room. But also because there's an opportunity to create a larger model that can be implemented, and because Miami is such an insanely, crazily diverse and complicated market anyway, if they can make it here, they can probably make it anywhere.
Well, Penny Schaefer says that it's all about economics.
Many of these hospitals would see these folks as uncompensated care. So the ability to put them into an insurance program, the ability to get compensated for the care, and the ability to let them access care actually prevents things that are absolutely catastrophic. You know, people who don't have insurance will let a cold become pneumonia. And by the time they get to the hospital, and it's an expensive hospital stay.
Again, that's Penny Schaefer, marketing president of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Florida. So how were people responding as you snaked yourself through that line that was moving from table to table?
The response was actually pretty good. I know everyone there was glad that something new is being done. There were a lot of questions in terms of the cost of it, whether they would be able to afford it, what they get for their money, what is a copay. I mean, you're dealing with a bunch of different people with wildly diverse levels of understanding of the health insurance market to begin with. So not only are you educating them on the plan, you're also educating them to an extent on this is what a premium is, this is what a copay is, this is how the system works.
Well, and the sound and voice of that education can be heard in one James Hampton, who you spoke with, an unemployed Dade County worker who was at the event yesterday.
You know, they're taking one thing and they're running with it. You know, the minute they hear the lady say $70, they're like, oh, that's too much. I mean, so what I'm saying is you need to come with a method, go into the community, you know, and make people understand. You know, we all need it, man.
Now, a lot of critics of healthcare reform say that education and so-called voluntary empowerment of people doesn't really go very far. You need mandates and you need really serious subsidies. How is that working yesterday?
Well, Miami-Dade County, in terms of a mandate and a subsidy, they're kind of thinking about that. There are efforts to try to create some kind of a fund, whether it's vested through grants, not tax dollars, but some kind of privately created fund to help people who can't pay the premiums or just can't pay for the plan in the beginning. In terms of a mandate, the Miami-Dade's Office of Countywide Health Planning determined that this is an emergency. It's something they have to do, but they decided that they're not in the healthcare business and they don't really want to get into the healthcare business, so they farmed it out to somebody else. So it's kind of the middle ground, it seems, between letting the private insurance companies just run wild and do whatever they want to do and saying private companies can't do it. It has to be government's responsibility. This seems to be kind of the hybrid of both of those schools of thought.
Josh Johnson Theater here in Miami. I love it when you come on the program, Josh.
You enjoying it for the morning?
I'm totally enjoying it.
Yeah.
But give us a takeaway here, a numerical takeaway. Is there a number that they want to reach, a target of getting uninsured on the rolls?
No, they don't even know if this is going to work. But I have one number that I can share with you, and it's what it would cost me personally. I went with my check stub for my employer, and what I pay, if we were employed with Miami-Dade Blue, which you can use for small businesses of up to 50 people,
right,
I would probably save about $25 a month on my health care.
Not bad.
Now, I don't know if it would cover the same things, but I know what I would spend that $25 on.
Very interesting. Josh Johnson, reporter and anchor with WLRN Miami Herald News, about a program in Miami-Dade County to take health care reform in the local level into their own hands. Thanks, Josh.
Anytime, my friend.
Love Josh. And now Mark Garrison has our headlines.
Thank you, John. 28 minutes after the hour, and the new monthly unemployment rate is now at 9.5%. That is a 26-year high. The new rate is slightly lower than predicted, though. Some 4,000 Marines are attacking Taliban insurgents in southern Afghanistan right now. It's the first major offensive there since President Obama took office. Here's Marine Captain Drew Schoenmaker on the reach of the assault.
The aim of the air assault was to put Marine Corps forces back expeditionary-wise out behind enemy lines. We dropped into a few places that nobody had been.
The U.S., along with Afghan military forces, are trying to clear insurgents from the area before the local presidential election next month. If you've got flight plans that include Chicago O'Hare or United Airlines today, good luck. There are delays and long lines following a major computer problem for the airline's operations there. Do check your flight status online before you head out. And the Drug Enforcement Administration is now involved in the probe into the Michael Jackson's death. The DEA will help local police look into the extent of Jackson's prescription drug use and any doctors involved. John.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. So the markets are just open. It's the early going yet, but based on the unemployment number, which was out earlier this morning, 9.5%, all three major indices are plummeting. The S&P, the Dow, and the NASDAQ are all down. Again, the markets have just opened within the last few minutes. But we go now to rugged, live Camp Leatherneck, Helmand Province, Afghanistan, where a major offensive in Afghanistan, in that province, is now underway. We learned of it last night, and Captain William Pelletier is the spokesman for the U.S. Marine Expeditionary Force, 4,000 troops, U.S. Marines, 650 Afghan soldiers. Is this, Captain Pelletier, and good morning to you, is this an attempt to grab territory in the pursuit of a counterinsurgency operation?
It's not so much to grab territory, get control of some territory to be able to clear it and then hold them so that the Afghan National Security Forces we're partnered with can come in, get firm control of the area, and start to bring in the civil affairs folks, the people that are in charge and connected with the governance and reconstruction of Helmand Province, which is the primary mission we're doing here.
All right, Captain. So, again, we don't want to violate any operational security rules here, but we would love to make some news this morning. You're describing a phased operation of taking territory, bringing the Afghan military in, and then the civil authorities on top of that. Do you have enough civil personnel to deal with a province of 1.2 million people?
The short answer is probably not enough people. So what we do is we have focused areas, and that's one of the reasons that our operations were phased into going into certain towns in the districts, the population centers, those key areas of influence, focusing on those and getting security established first in order to be able to set the conditions for the follow-on. So the reason it's been such a carefully phased approach is because we have to husband our resources and make sure that we're, focusing those to produce the best effects.
And I can hear those resources moving around right now, right around you there at Camp Leatherneck in Helmand Province. Is this operation being commanded by General McChrystal from Camp Leatherneck, or is CENTCOM running this show?
I couldn't say above the level of Brigadier General Larry Nicholson, who's the commanding general for the Med. Obviously, we take our guidance from General McChrystal's his themes, his philosophy. He was down here a few days ago being briefed on this operation and other things. So we understand his priorities. We understand very much his sensitivities and concerns going into an operation like this. And that's one of the factors that's had a very strong influence in developing this operation for us.
Oh, Captain Pelletier, well said, and that's fair enough. I don't need any more details there. We are getting reports that there has been movement on the Pakistan side of the border to bring troops up to the border to prevent Taliban from escaping into Pakistan. Do you know if your commanders, and can you say if your commanders are in essentially operational contact with the Pakistanis at this point?
I don't know. I really don't. Obviously, lines of communication from Pakistan have been an issue for us since we got here, even when it wasn't part of our battle space. It was something that still affected our operations because there are smuggling and supply lines that come up from Pakistan that interdiction of and maintaining an awareness of those things has been a priority for us. Hello?
Yep, Captain. Two more things before we go. First of all, does this operation have a name? And there a lot of people listening to this program. Captain, can you hear me?
Okay, yeah, I got you. I'm sorry.
Okay, it's all right. A lot of people listening to this program are wondering about casualties. Do you have any sort of guidance for people listening back home?
So far, the only Marines that we've had injured in this, a couple that got injured during the initial insert, one hurt his leg and had to be evac'd out. Nothing serious is what I'm told. It's 110 degrees down here. We are in the Helmand Desert, so we've had some injuries with Marines that basically needed to be taken back, cooled down, and hydrated. But no reports that I have heard. We don't have anything about friendly casualties. Nobody KIA anyway. Fortunately, this no confirmed reports on enemy KIA, and have not heard any reports of any civilian casualties.
Well, we are certainly updated there, Captain William Pelletier. Thanks so much. We appreciate that report from Camp Leatherneck in the middle of the Helmand Desert in Helmand Province, Afghanistan. Thanks so much, sir. And the offensive, as we've been reporting all morning, has been going on since last night, the local time here in the United States. 4,000 Marines, 650 Afghan soldiers. Some assessments saying it's the biggest Marine offensive since the operations in Fallujah in Iraq. Others have said it's the biggest Marine operation alone since the Vietnam era. But more details on this and other stories now from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. It's coming up on 22 minutes before the hour.
You need me to do the time. You do the headlines, I'll do the time.
In any case, that number I do know for sure, it's 9.5%. That is the monthly unemployment figures just out this morning. That is a 26-year high, and it's a touch lower than analysts expected. A new report is just out on the Rio to Paris crash a month ago. French investigators now say the Airbus did not break up in flight before it hit the water. It appears to have hit the water intact. The search for the flight's black box will continue through July 10th. As we have been talking about, though, the signals in the black box, they normally only last about 30 days, so that stuff is getting much tougher. Now, several states' budgets are in trouble, including California's. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger now declares a fiscal state of emergency. He wants to close more state offices to save money. California is set to issue billions of dollars in IOUs starting today. South Korea's defense ministry now confirms a new North Korean test of 3 short-range missiles. This follows U.N. sanctions on Pyongyang for recent tests on nuclear device. They're on alert for other launches. North Korea has issued a warning for ships to stay away from the East Coast all the way through July 10th, so there could be another full week of tests. Back in the U.S., federal officials are looking closely at meat from the JBS Swift Beef Company. It's been linked to a possible E. coli outbreak after at least 12 people have been hospitalized. We have some more information about this on our website if you want to find out which stores this may be in, how to find out more, how to reach the CDC. That's at thetakeaway.org.
You know, men are being affected by that 9.5% unemployment rate. You know that?
Well, we had that good conversation earlier today about the kind of gender differences in the unemployment rate. And
listen
so,
to this. People are calling. Listen to this.
This is Michelle from Detroit, and I'm 41 years old. I've been single for a long time and have been dating for a long time. And what I would say has changed about men is when I was younger, they cared, you know, who drove and who bought and who made more money. And in the last probably 10 years, they don't care anymore. So I think that macho part is definitely going away.
The recession is taking macho away. Listen to this one.
Starting to see men are cutting grass more, plumbing jobs, any kind of way to hustle them just to make ends meet. Help, help us.
The faces and voices behind the recession, 9.5% unemployment rate, 877-8-MY-TAKE with what you're seeing. Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Continuing now on our discussion of Afghanistan, an offensive that was announced yesterday in Helmand Province. Joining us now, Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a former assistant secretary of defense on the line from Atlanta. Larry, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You know, I'm dying to ask you, we had some discussion this morning on the program that possibly the scale of this offensive suggests that there may be some disagreement between General Jones, National Security Advisor, and David Petraeus on how to proceed, and even some discussion of maybe General McChrystal in Afghanistan isn't really running this show here in Afghanistan. What do you think?
Well, I'd be very surprised if General McChrystal is not running it because he's really a take charge person. And remember, he actually flew over to Afghanistan even as the Senate was voting on it. And I think the indication, obviously, he would check with General Petraeus, but I think it's a much more aggressive strategy. And he's a very aggressive, aggressive general.
Sure.
I mean, he's.
Sure. Well, let's talk about the tactics then. It's my assumption here, and I more about this than I do, that the U.S. forces need to take territory in Afghanistan if they're going to do the kind of village by village counterinsurgency work that General Petraeus was so effectively able to do in Iraq. Do you think that's the case?
Well, I again, it's a little bit different because in Iraq, they could actually move into the cities and live in vacant houses. They can't do that in Afghanistan. I mean, there's just no room for them to go in there. But what I think they want to do is go in, stay in stay in the area after they get the Taliban out, because what's happened before, given the small number of troops, basically they would go in and take on the Taliban, then they leave, and the Taliban Taliban would come back. So I think with more troops, they can stay more in the area. But there's no way they can live in the villages to the extent that they did in Iraq.
And it seems to me there's no way 4,000 Marines and 650 Afghan soldiers can seriously protect 1.2 million people in Helmand Province.
No, they can't. But I think psychologically what they're trying to do is show that they're going to be more, you know, more aggressive and just take one small part after the other. Because as your previous guest mentioned, and I think that's correct, the Taliban are not very popular even in the areas where they are.
Right.
So I think psychologically they're trying to turn the tide. All of the troops are not there yet. These 4,000 Marines, they actually were sent by former President Bush. But I think they just don't want to allow this thing to get away from them anymore. And we've got domestic problems here at home.
Well,
let's
focus on that before we go. Under a minute, how big of a gamble is this for Barack Obama? The profile of Iraq and Afghanistan has been relatively low for the American people. But what is the chance that we're going to start seeing cameras at Dover looking at U.S. casualties?
Well, I don't think you're going to see the casualties to the extent that you did in Iraq. You're going to see more casualties, and I think that's why they want to move quickly, because this year when the Congress was voting the funds for Afghanistan, they said, what are the metrics? When are we going to know something, and when is the tide going to turn? And objectively on the ground, it has been getting worse.
Clock is ticking. Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and former assistant secretary of defense, talking about the surge in Afghanistan. Thank you, Larry.
You're welcome. Bye.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Big news out this morning, 9.5% unemployment rate, and the markets are reacting negatively to that. And to men, most negatively of all, most of the job losses during this recession have been borne by men. Is it changing the notion of macho in the United States?
This is Layla from Detroit, Michigan, and I hope that not only is macho dead, but misogyny. And so even though this is a painful transition, I hope that we come out at the other end stronger and better as a society.
Call us with your notion of where macho stands in this economy, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. The rest of the headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. 12 minutes before the hour, and we're talking all morning about the offensive in Afghanistan. We just heard live from one of the American Marines on the ground there. Elsewhere in that country, the Pentagon says insurgents have captured an American soldier missing since Tuesday. The search is on now. Again, this is not connected with the new offensive. The missing soldier is in the east, the new offensive going on down south. In California, the state is ready to issue billions in IOUs starting today after Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger declared a fiscal emergency. Dozens of states missed a June 30th deadline to balance their budgets. Check your flight online before going through Chicago O'Hare on United. There are delays and long lines following a major computer problem for the airline's operations there. The Drug Enforcement Agency is getting involved in the investigation of Michael Jackson's death. They'll help the local officials look at allegations that he used painkillers, sedatives, and antidepressants. Talk to any doctors that may have been involved in that. Staying abroad and going abroad, rather, the interim Honduran leader blames Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez for rising arrest in Honduras. There's a tighter curfew in place there. Supporters of both the interim and exiled leaders are holding counter demonstrations. John.
Thank you, Mark. Well, the issue of how to do right and who's a fool in the strange battlefield between men and women was certainly raised by South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, who, in one of his many puzzling, too much information kinds of statements since last Thursday, was this, it seems to me, battle cry or cry for help.
I'm quite certain that there were a handful of instances wherein I crossed lines that I shouldn't have crossed as a married man, but never crossed the ultimate line.
Now, we can be reasonably certain that the ultimate line he's talking about there isn't divorce, and that's up to his wife anyway. The ultimate line, it's kind of a euphemism about sexual relations. Maybe this one is familiar to you as well.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky.
Okay, but then what did he have? Audacia Ray rejoins us now. She's the author of Naked on the Internet and is adjunct professor of sexuality at Rutgers University. Back in the studio. Audacia, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Debbie Herbenek is a research scientist at the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University and author of the forthcoming book, Because It Feels Good, A Woman's Guide to Sexual Pleasure and Satisfaction. Debbie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How much of a moving target, Audacia, is this idea of the ultimate line or, we're all familiar with the sort of baseball metaphors of first base, second base, third base. I mean, what is Mark Sanford talking about, Audacia?
I mean, I think it's not so much just about the idea of what is sex, but also what is the ultimate line in violating relationship vows, especially in a marriage. So there's definitely a divide between what people consider that line to be in sex and what that line is when you're violating what you agreed with your spouse.
I mean, in fact, married people talk about this all the time, Debbie, that there's a line that is physical, right? There's also a line that is linguistic in the sense that you are saying things that maybe permit a kind of open-ended interpretation of what's going on here. How do we mediate that sort of thing, Debbie?
Well, unfortunately, what happens is married couples do and they don't talk about these things. There's often very little shared understanding or shared meaning of what it really does mean to cross a line. So often you have one person who has done something and the other partner may say, well, you shouldn't have done that. You know, that crossed the line. That went too far. And the other one can sometimes claim ignorance.
I think that's very much rooted in a communication problem, too, that couples assume monogamy but don't talk about what that means exactly.
Well, let's just look at the Sanford case. I mean, if you follow the news, on Thursday he admitted that he actually, you know, vanished for 4 days and went to Argentina to spend time with his mistress. Now, this was presumably the first time he disclosed that he actually not only left the country but was sleeping with her and had been doing it for a long time. Then he admitted that he had other sorts of affairs. We can presume from this that the governor had something of a non-communicative relationship with his wife up to last week. Right, Debbie?
We can assume that this wasn't discussed. It does seem that they had had some discussion earlier, at least from a few different reports. But in any case, it doesn't, you know, it's very unclear if it was honest communication.
Right.
I mean, there have been several different stories already that he's woven to the media. And as often happens in couples, you know, it's up for grabs whether or not what happened actually gave his wife any real information about what he had been doing.
Well, based on both of your work, Audacia and Debbie, it's actually very difficult. Maybe it's not almost impossible, but it is difficult for men and women to be honest in the sense that the statistics show that what men consider sex and what women consider sex varies radically by community culture and even whether we're talking about today or 20, 30 years ago. Audacia?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true as far as the statistics go. But I think the place where that can be bridged is, you know, where people need to talk more about what they consider sex and what they consider cheating. And, you know, I mean, he says, Sanford says that, you know, he shouldn't have even danced with another woman. And, you know, maybe some wives would be okay with that. Maybe dancing is permissible in some relationships and not in others.
Debbie, is dancing permissible?
Well, you know, again, that does vary by relationship. But I find this challenging because it is, as you were saying, a moving target. What someone considers sex or cheating or okay or not okay early in a relationship often changes. And people don't always inform their partner that their perspective has changed. And often people, you know, give themselves excuses, such as when they say that, well, it's not just sex. I've fallen in love, and this is now a love story. And being in love sometimes gives you certain permissions that maybe you wouldn't have given yourself before.
But that's also could be a different level of violation of a relationship that, you know, there's, quote unquote, just sex. And then there's falling in love with someone, which is a totally different kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Right. Some relationships actually permit the sex, but it's the love that's forbidden.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah. Some say as soon as you start to get emotionally attached, it's time to stop.
Huh. Now, when Bill Clinton said, I didn't have sexual relations with that woman, he was basically suggesting that oral sex is all right, okay? Because that's what we found out later was actually going on. Now, in my upbringing, that just seemed like an insane proposition for my generation. But in fact, for people who are in their 20s today, it's not insane at all. It actually makes total sense, right, Debbie?
Well, I think, you know, the fact that he didn't include oral sex as sex doesn't necessarily reflect a sense that oral sex was all right within his relationships, but that it wasn't sex. Mm-hmm. And it is the case that many, especially heterosexual people, do not identify oral sex as sex, but it changes. I mean, some people I've worked with in interviews and research studies, when I've asked them how many partners they've had, they may say two in the past few months, but later on a third name will come up. And when I ask why they didn't, you know, include that person earlier, they'll say anything from, well, it was only oral sex, to, well, sure, it was vaginal intercourse or anal intercourse, but I didn't really like him or her that much, or, you know, it wasn't very good, or it only lasted 2 minutes. And so people use so many qualifiers.
Maybe it's the qualifiers. You know, ultimate line is another qualifier. Audacia, is that consistent with the kinds of things that you see?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also part of this is a generational thing that relates to risk, and that because oral sex is, you know, risky in terms of transmitting sexually transmitted infections, but it's less so than vaginal and anal sex. That figures into the whole picture also.
All right. Well, you know, breakfast conversation here this morning on The Takeaway. Audacia Ray, author of Naked on the Internet and adjunct professor of sexuality at Rutgers University. Thanks so much for being here. And Debbie Herbenick, a research scientist at the Center for Sexual Health Promotion at Indiana University. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
And I'm still macho. We want to know, what are the visible effects of the changing workforce in your community? How do you think the fact that 80% of the people who have been laid off during this recession are men, how it's going to change the way men and women deal with each other? Are we seeing the end of macho culture and a revival of perhaps another time in history?
She's making history, working for victory, Rosie. The riveter keeps a sharp lookout for sabotage, sitting up there on the fuselage. That little frail can do more than a male can do, Rosie.
Our own riveter, New York Times, Mickey Maynard, tweeted us an answer to the question about macho. She says, is macho dead? In a word, no. Well, she should know. You can follow us on Twitter, too. Our name is the_takeaway, or you can email us with your take at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here is your takeaway on the unemployment rate.
It is possible that we could stay under that double-digit unemployment rate. So just giving us a sense of how bad things are, I will say the loss of 6.5 million jobs since the recession began takes us back to the overall employment level the economy had in 2000. It wipes out 9 years.
I'd love to lose 9 years like Kelly Evans. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.